You've been listening to your leaders tell you that there is a great move toward democracy in the world. You witnessed the parting of the Iron Curtain, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the fracturing of the Soviet Union. And this is all supposedly toward a new worldwide democracy. The problem lies within each and every one of you, and therein also lies the answer.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Many have said the Nazis and the Bolsheviks were singing from the devil's same hymn sheet. More evidence tonight, they may be right. Also, a German soldier is arrested for acts preparing a terror attack at Vienna airport. His plan was to blame his attack on Syrian refugees. How would he get away with that? And why, more to the point, has this hardly been reported in the UK? Why do our press spike the story if a terrorist is a white non-Muslim? Also, close ties between Israel and ISIS revealed as ISIS apologised for accidentally attacking an Israeli army patrol. And why did the Gestapo pick on the Freemasons? There's a new TV series at the moment on Sky One on every Monday evening, and we get a review of that inside the Freemasons. That's one of the questions they never asked on that programme from an ex-Freemason. Also, sticking with the Nazis, Hitler's deputy Rudolf Hess flew alone to Scotland in 1941 on a secret peace mission just before the Nazis invaded the Soviet Union. But why did he spend the rest of his life alone in Berlin's Spandau prison with no outside contact allowed? What did Hess know? And a UBS whistleblower this week, Christoph Miley, with more evidence that his bank were funding ISIS and Al-Qaeda through numbered accounts, just like the 1930s when they funded the Nazis' rise to power and rearmament. Swiss banksters make lots of money from war, then they steal the money from the victims. Our sister show Dialect is here at BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. This week, former Mason Ian Matteson tells us what's been missing so far from this current Monday night Sky One series Inside the Freemasons, a special on that next week. He wonders whether it's been commissioned and produced for Rupert Murdoch by the Masons themselves. That's Dialect at noon next Tuesday. Listen again at bcfmradio.com/dialect, or if you can't wait, you can download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. But first, Martin, you flagged this up to me during the meet. You emailed me about it. ISIS apologising for attacking an Israeli patrol.
Well, if you'll see, the article's from the Jerusalem Post, and an Israeli minister says that they'd had a clash with ISIS inside Syria, but that ISIS had apologised and they're all back to being chums again. Although, of course, ISIS are supposedly our bitterest enemies, and supposedly the bitterest enemies of the State of Israel, but apparently not.
But no, they're not, are they? Because ISIS themselves say that they would prefer to get rid of all of the Muslims that don't agree with them before they'll take on any Jews.
Well, the suspicion by the Syrian general staff, the Iranian general staff and the Russian general staff is that ISIS is in fact run by the Saudis, the Turks, the Israelis, the British, the Qataris and the French and the Americans. And of course, they're right. At the same time as we pretend to be opposing them.
What about the Kuwaitis?
Oh, well, they're involved as well. Yes. But I mean, the point is that ISIS is presented as this boogeyman thing that we've got to be opposed to. And all the evidence, I mean, the Israelis have been flying close air support for ISIS. The RAF flew close air support for ISIS at the Desert Zor attack, where an RAF drone flown from RAF Waddington helped to kill over 60 Syrian soldiers. And ISIS coordinated their attack with that air assault. The same thing happened with the Tomahawk tweet on the Syrian airbase. ISIS took advantage to attack the airbase whilst NATO obligingly provided the air cover. And I think the Syrian army and the Russian army are pretty clear that we are the air force for ISIS.
Before we get on to this Nazi stuff, this research this week, let's have a bit of a fly around the world first. South Korea, these missiles have actually been being deployed this week by the United States, as well as their carriers chugging towards the peninsula.
Yeah, well, there's a general presidential election going on in South Korea, and the leader, whose name I can't remember, but
well, actually, no, the president is in jail. It's a woman.
That's right. It was a conservative president enforced out through because of corruption. So they're having a presidential election, and the front runner in that presidential election is of liberal disposition. And they basically are saying, well, we don't want a confrontation with North Korea. We'd rather just negotiate with North Korea. We certainly don't want this high-level missile battery to be deployed. And, of course, Trump was saying at one stage, it costs us $1 billion to employ this. You've got to pay for it. They're saying, well, we're not paying for it for two reasons. We're not paying for it. And secondly, we don't want it. It shouldn't be there. The Chinese don't want it there either, because this doesn't do anything to protect South Korea's security. It's a way of threatening the Chinese, and of course they don't like it, and they've started sanctions against South Korea on the basis that they've got to get
okay,
rid of this
look,
system.
Call me cynical, but do the American Pentagon really care any more about South Korean lives than North Korean lives?
No, they don't. And of course the South Koreans are going to get a chance to vote in their election and say, well, actually we don't want this war policy. And of course that could be very good, because the Americans will then be all dressed up with nowhere to go.
Well, there's been several protests also in South
Korea,
as well as in Okinawa.
Where they've tried to deploy it, the locals have all tried to blockade it and prevent it from being deployed. You've got to remember that South Korea's got a very checkered history. The various military strongmen who've run South Korea over the years, backed by the West, have been pretty brutal. They killed, during the 1950s, before the Korean War broke out, the South Korean dictator, backed by the West, killed hundreds of thousands of suspected communists. And, of course, during the Korean War itself, 20% of the North Korean population was killed by Allied bombing. 20%. And, of course, they remember this.
Well, if you've not watched it already...
We've forgotten about it, but they haven't.
We've a link on a show page from a couple of weeks ago to John Pilger's excellent most recent documentary, the Australian filmmaker. He was making stuff for World in Action, wasn't he? Back in the 1970s, I seem to remember. And still going strong. Brilliant filmmaker. So I'll put a link to that again on this week's show page. The Coming War on China is the name of that film. But we're not finished with North Korea yet, Martin, because the Pentagon is seeking to link Iran and North Korea, saying that they've got similar-looking missiles.
Ooh, what? They're pointy. Pointy missiles. Mm. And of course, the other thing they were saying is that the Syrians who supposedly carried out the chemical weapons attack, although all the evidence suggests that they didn't, just like the previous one, they apparently, Fox News was saying that, well, they get their chemical weapons from North Korea, and as we know, that these regimes are all in cahoots to frustrate the march of freedom.
I mean, it's difficult for the journalists, isn't it? Because they're thinking, well, we've just got to report what they say rather than question it, and it's difficult to question what these.
Well, it's not just that they actually go out. I mean, you don't become a New York Times journalist by questioning the party line, and if you do, you soon get removed. Seymour Hersh has written in the London Review of Books, the New York Review of Books wouldn't publish it, The Red Lines and the Rat Lines, which pretty conclusively showed that the chemical weapons attack a couple of years ago was definitely carried out by the rebels with sarin from Libya, helped by NATO.
Well, you're talking about Libya. America has just been boosting its presence in Libya. It's a new big American base in the south of Libya.
Yes, and the Russians are also talking to various factions about their people coming in there, and the Egyptians are intervening. And of course, there's nobody controlling that coastline. And as it comes to summer now, we're going to get thousands and thousands of people coming across the Mediterranean trying to get into the European Union because there's nobody to control the coastline anymore, because we got rid of the existing government and we've replaced it with a chaotic mess, which is pretty much what we've done in Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan and various other
places.
Great
that you mentioned Afghanistan. I was just going to mention that as well. Pentagon is pitching an Afghan war plan to Trump next week. It's talking about a whole new surge, loads more troops going back to Afghanistan.
Well, do you remember when we...
The British are going to go too, apparently.
Oh, yes. Oh, well, don't forget Helmand province is now firmly under the control of the Taliban.
It's only, I think, a third of the country is now controlled by the Afghan government.
Yes. Well, don't forget, when we opposed the Afghan war originally, various people said, oh, no, we've got to do something about Al-Qaeda or whatever. There was no evidence that that Al-Qaeda were necessarily directly involved in the 9/11 attacks, apart from the claims made by the West. And we were told that those who opposed the war in Afghanistan, that it would all be over very quickly. And when they seized Kabul and the Northern Alliance took power, the previous allied Dostan, previously allied with the Russians, took power, we were told that was all over, and the pacifists were all wrong, and in actual fact, you know, the war was over really quickly and it was a much better setup. Now where are we now, decades later, talking about sending soldiers back to Afghanistan? And you know what, we can carry on sending our soldiers to Afghanistan forever. We will never beat the Afghans. The Taliban are already in negotiations with the government, because they've got to be. The government's got to be in negotiations with them. When Trump dropped his mother of all bombs the other week, apparently the military did that without telling him, but then he claimed credit. Hamid Karzai, who used to be their puppet, said this is intolerable. You're just using this as an experimental place to use your weapons. You've got to ask yourself the question, well, what is this? Is it a democratic government in Afghanistan that we're defending? No, it's a narco state.
And is it a democratic government in the United States that's doing these actions?
Well, indeed. Trump didn't win the most votes in the election. Under the American system, that still makes him
but
the president.
It's the system. Yeah, well, here, you know, you could quite easily, if you lose in lots of constituencies, you could quite easily become a winning party without winning the majority of votes.
Yeah, but you can say, well, that's our system. But the communists in China say, that's our system.
Yeah.
They say, we win every election. We do have elections, but our system is you've got to be in the communist party.
I agree with you. I think it would be sensible to move to something a little bit more mature, like PR here in Britain. But anyway, we're not there, and they're not in America. So breaking. Also, another story relating back to Syria, we talked about in Israel earlier with ISIS. The Israeli Air Force has been bombing, hasn't it? Quite a lot. Down in Damascus and places like that. As the Israelis then also, they say, well, this is consistent with our policy, but they neither confirm nor deny they're even doing it. So is this just an undeclared war?
It is, yes. Effectively, we are supporting Al-Qaeda. The Israelis are supporting Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And we're now back on the programme of getting rid of Assad, even though he won the democratic election that he held in Syria a few years ago. Now, people say it's not really democratic, whatever. It was good enough. It's good enough to keep his army fighting, even though they've taken tens of thousands of casualties and they're still fighting, because they know that victory is the only option for them. They cannot possibly allow the country to be overrun by foreign jihadis supported by Saudi Arabia and NATO. It's not going to happen. They're not going to crumble. And if Britain and Theresa May wants to go to war with Syria, we will be in the wrong and they will win. And unfortunately, there'll have to be British casualties, because that's the only language that people understand.
I mean, Syria is likely to be won or lost in the air. We're hearing that from midnight tonight, Syrian safe zones will be closed by Russia to all US coalition planes. De-escalation zones in Syria are going to be closed for warplanes of US-led international coalition, says the Russian envoy. Safe zones that regional powers have agreed to create in Syria will be closed to all military planes of the international US-led coalition, Russia's envoy to Syria talks said. Turkey and Iran agreed on Thursday to Russia's proposal for de-escalation zones, a move welcomed by the UN but met with scepticism from the US and from Syrian rebel groups. So you're right, they do seem to be aligned on this anyway. Speaking from the Syrian summit in the Kazakh capital Astana on Thursday, Russian envoy Alexander Lavrentyev said that Syrian government fighter jets are also not expected to fly over the de-escalation zones for 6 months. So what will happen if the Americans do decide they want to fly over these zones
from
midnight?
Well, I understand that Trump and Putin have had a telephone conversation about this. So it may be that the policy is aligned, but it may not be. I mean, it's a very dangerous situation, because a miscalculation by anybody, the Turks have signed up to this agreement, and of course some of the rebels aren't happy with this. This kind of trying to find an agreement is what we should have been doing all along, instead of pushing the idea Assad must go, Assad must go, Assad must go. He's always said he's prepared to stand in an election. And they're saying, but we don't want you to stand in an election. You're a butcher. Well, so's President Sisi in Egypt, he's a butcher. Donald Trump, he's a butcher. As he rightly said, what makes us so innocent? He's quite right. Since 9/11, the US has been responsible for millions of civilian deaths.
And what about since World War II?
Well, we're talking since World War II, and particularly in the 1980s, when they were supporting the Contra rebels in Nicaragua, who killed 30,000 civilians, RENAMO in Mozambique, which killed another million or so, UNITA in Angola. They devastated these countries, absolutely devastated them.
Yeah, but they're our greatest ally.
Who's our greatest ally?
The United States.
Well, indeed. And, of course, once we leave the European Union, as we're going to, then the Americans will tell us what to do and we will just do it. It'll be yes, sir, no, sir, three bags full, sir.
Don't you think that there's to any extent, Britain is a moderating influence on the US or
not?
No,
not at all. In actual fact, it seems to me that the city of London, the British establishment and military industrial complex, they are definitely part of the problem, not part of the solution. When Trump was talking more pacifically towards the Russians, for example, Boris Johnson stomped in and tried to stir things up further. And that's because we are, you know, the City of London and Wall Street are pretty much the axis of evil, really.
It's like the Buddington Club and the Skull and Bones running the whole of the Western world, effectively, although I think quite a lot of Europeans don't like it like that.
No, well, I mean, as you know, Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister under Mitterrand, not under Sarkozy, he was interviewed on the TV in France some years ago, and he said, before the Arab Spring, I was approached by British officials who said to me, we are going to run an armed uprising in Syria. Do you want to participate?
Well, that was whilst David Miliband was Foreign Secretary.
Well, indeed, and that just means that new Labour...
I don't know if any of the BBC people have put that question to him yet.
Well, I mean, it's quite obvious that the vast majority of mainstream British politicians are absolutely unaware that we started the war in Syria. And I don't suppose we did it on our own. We'll have done it on behalf of the
I mean, David Miliband was also supervising torture whilst he was Foreign Secretary.
Indeed he was.
Well, not directly, but he was certainly signing it off.
Yeah.
I mean, just explain how this works, because, I mean, people like foreign secretaries, prime ministers, etc., will they not just sign off some of these things like special operations using special forces?
No,
if everything goes wrong, then the intelligence services will deny that the prime minister has actually signed these things.
Well, the fact of the matter is that they basically kept in the dark. It's not as if they wouldn't go along with it. They probably would go along with it, but it's easier if they're not told anything. All this stuff happens. I mean, the funding for the White Helmets via James Lemessurier, the former British intelligence officer based in Turkey. I saw David Miliband was tweeting the pictures of the poor child that was covered in dust that had been rescued by the White Helmets. Wasn't it terrible? The Swedish Doctors for Human Rights have brought out a report suggesting that the White Helmets not only are not a humanitarian organisation, but they're actually actively involved in killing children whilst they're pretending to save them so that they can blame the government. And that's all paid for by the US and British taxpayer, the British taxpayer in particular.
I agree.
We pay for this.
Always follow the money. And the British London media are simply not doing this at all. One of the fascinating interviews I've read over the last week from the Foundation for Defence of Democracies in the US, article written by David Andrew Weinberg, terror financiers are operating openly in Qatar and Kuwait. A White House readout following President Trump's phone conversation Thursday with the Emir of Qatar. So the two leaders discussed stopping terror finance throughout the region. Washington has good reason to raise the issue. Just last week, Obama administration's Assistant Treasury Secretary for Terrorist Financing, that is actually, since Trump took over, and his name is Daniel Glazer, revealed that designated terrorist financiers continue to operate openly in Qatar and its Gulf neighbour Kuwait.
Yeah. I mean, why is anybody surprised? I mean, we've been in alliance with these places for years.
Why is nothing done about this? I mean, we're supposedly fighting these terror groups.
Yeah, but that's only supposedly.
And yet we know that they're getting their money from these countries. We're doing absolutely nothing about it. Not only that, we won't even mention it.
No, that's
it's
right.
It's taboo.
We're basically being fed a diet of lies, propaganda and war criminality. And can I just stress that if people don't believe any of the things we're saying, then go to our show page, thisweek.org.
.uk.
.uk, and that we will put the
They'll
links
put
so
links
that you can, do your,
tonight,
own, you can
yeah.
do your own research. I mean, there's no real excuse in the modern era for being ignorant about this. The whole world, the dogs in the street in the Middle East know that NATO supports jihadi terrorists. Our closest allies are Saudi Arabia, who've invaded Yemen and Bahrain. And, of course, in Bristol, people working up at Filton earn a good living supplying the Saudis, who are the biggest supporters of terrorism on the planet, with weaponry. And that's how we make our living. And they are our allies. And they are also the terrorists.
In the meantime, former Premier Hoss has joined the Palestinian hunger strike. He's the former Premier of Lebanon. This is a Palestinian hunger strike which has been going on now by political prisoners, not dissimilar to the Northern Ireland hunger strike, for 2 weeks now. Virtually no reporting whatever in the London media or much of the Western media.
Well, what happens is that things which are not considered to be important...
I mean, the former Prime Minister is joining the hunger strike.
Well, he's in Lebanon, yes.
Yeah.
Well, he's joining it in solidarity, presumably.
But this isn't being reported at all.
No, it'll be reported in the area. The Palestinian press will be reporting it to their people. We've got far too many other things to think about. What about Brexit? We haven't got time for hunger strikes in Palestine. We've got to talk about Brexit, 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 Brexit. More Brexit, more Brexit, Brexit. Are you against Brexit? Are you for Brexit?
So look, just look. Look at this. Why is it that something so important as a 2 week long so far and carrying on, hundreds of political prisoners on hunger strike, many of whom have been interred without trial? Well, we're not interested.
Well, we are on this show, and the fact is that, of course, I don't know how far they're going to push it. I mean, in Turkey, there have been hunger strikes in the prisons where, you know, scores of people have died, and even that hasn't managed to change anything. So we'll have to see. But, I mean, we're moving towards a general war in the Middle East. That's where we're going. And... Theresa May's strong and stable government will make sure that we get involved, and of course there will be consequences for that.
Okay, well, talking about a general war, that sort of thing. I mean, no, we're not saying, I don't think, on this programme it's going to happen. What we're saying is, it's certainly the indications are there, and we need to be just sensibly ready if something like that does happen. And one of the Hustings last week, so we haven't had done this for the last week. We were actually effectively, I suppose, doing 2 weeks tonight of this international stuff. But one of the things that was about 2 weeks ago that this happened was the discussion about Jeremy Corbyn's foreign policy, and then afterwards Michael Fallon saying that he would be prepared to do a nuclear first strike. So let's have a little listen. That was on the Nick Ferrari show on LBC, following Jeremy Corbyn's appearance on the Mars show on the BBC. So let's have a listen to that clip with Michael Fallon, the Defence Secretary, talking about Jeremy Corbyn with Nick Ferrari on LBC now.
I mean, it's not just unimpressive, but, alarming. It's clearly putting Mr. Corbyn and Labour as a security risk to this country. If you're not prepared to authorise strikes against terrorists, we've seen terrorist attacks directly inspired by ISIL in Paris just last week. He's not prepared to endorse the nuclear deterrent and would stop building our new nuclear submarines, which we've already started building in Barrow. And the other day, he even questioned our deployment in NATO. Last week I was in Estonia with British and French troops helping to deter Russian aggression on the eastern side of NATO. So this was an alarming performance, and I think shows Jeremy Corbyn and Labour as a risk to the security of this country.
And you would be happy to have first use of, as he describes it, nuclear weapons?
Yeah, we've made it very clear that you must always make sure the enemy is not sure whether you would use your deterrent or not. If you go out, if you rule out using the deterrent in any particular circumstances, you remove that uncertainty. And the whole point of the deterrent, and we use the deterrent every day, every night, 24 hours, every day of every year, we're using that deterrent to leave any potential adversaries in doubt as to how we would respond. That's the purpose of the deterrent.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because we're not talking about we would use it to strike back. We're saying we don't say that we wouldn't use it first. Now, if you think about it, there's no way you can say that somebody wouldn't necessarily use it first. They might say they weren't going to use it first, but then use it first. But what we agreed in the 1970s, that we were going to take a step back from this, and everybody, for example, the ABM treaty in 1972 between Nixon and the Soviets, was that we wouldn't have these missiles which are designed for first strike. In other words, that could knock out a retaliatory strike. But what we are doing now, what NATO is doing now, is moving first strike weapons into Estonia, into Kaliningrad, into Poland and Romania, and that then puts the Russian defences on a hair trigger, which is what happened in the 1980s when the cruise missiles were deployed. And you know what? We nearly had a nuclear war in 1983 by accident, because the only response, when if they feel that the Russians feel that there's a danger of first strike, their only response to that is to go onto hair trigger alert. So they immediately hit back whenever they think.
But you heard Michael Fallon there. He's saying that it's really important to have a policy where your enemy, potential enemy anyway, doesn't know that you might use nuclear weapons first.
Well, we've made it pretty clear by deploying these missile systems in Romania and Poland that we are prepared to do a first strike. Now, and they're also saying, Michael Fallon's just said that we're going to do a first strike, or we're not ruling it out. Now, on that basis, the Russian general staff has to plan. They can't try and carry out a first strike. Now, our only response to that, and they haven't said this, but both the Russians and the Chinese said, we don't believe in first strikes. But what we will do is we'll put our stuff on a hair trigger alert. So if we see you coming at us in any way, shape or form, we're immediately going to go to full DEFCON 3 and we're going to retaliate. And that's what nearly happened in 1983. In actual fact, because of all the rhetoric that Reagan and Thatcher were coming out with, in actual fact, the Soviets really thought they were going to be attacked. And because they really thought they were going to be attacked, they then put all of their people on absolutely hair trigger alert, which means that everybody's on hair trigger alert all the time. And what happened was there was a flock of swans which got misinterpreted by the Soviet system as an air attack, and they nearly fired back. And the only thing that stopped them firing back, the guy decided not to follow orders, not to follow procedure, and he didn't press the button.
Okay,
and that's the only thing that saved us in 1980.
In the film I was mentioning earlier, in John Pilger's The Coming War on China, there's an incident during the Cuban Missile Crisis where there is an order to launch the nuclear force against China from the Pacific weapons that the Americans have got, and it was only some rather smart officer saying this can't be true because China is not part of this disagreement with the Soviet Union, and it was only by this guy actually threatening with a gun some officer that wanted to launch their nuclear weapons at China that stopped it happening.
Yeah, so both in the Cuban Missile Crisis and in 1983, people know about the Cuban Missile Crisis. They don't know what happened in 1983. Eventually, the Soviets had a spy at the top of NATO who was able to reassure them that NATO was bluffing and that they weren't going to carry out a first strike. But if people like Fallon say, we're going to carry out a first strike, well, the Russians are going to take you at their word.
That's not what he said, is it?
No, he did say that. He said, we are prepared to carry out a first strike. We're not going to say to the Russians, we won't attack first. Now, the Russians, it couldn't be plainer. If you were the Russian general, So what you're saying is you are prepared to attack us first. Now, in that case, we will have to take whatever measures we're going to have to take. And that includes being ready to smack you in the face really hard at a moment's notice. So if we think or suspect that you are about to carry out a first strike on us, we will have to carry out a first strike on you, because that's the implication. Now, of course, the way out of this is for everybody to deny a first strike, and we can all take a step back, and nobody's going to use nuclear weapons, are they? Surely not. But, of course, the NATO policy is to threaten to use nuclear weapons. And, of course, the Americans threatened to use nuclear weapons in Korea in the 1950s and against the North Vietnamese. And do you know what the North Vietnamese said to them? Go on, bring it on. You're bluffing. But, of course, they threatened to use them.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Another UBS whistleblower, Martin, this week. His name's Christoph Miley. I interviewed him last week for Dialect. A fascinating interview. He was around in 1997 as a security guard at the bank UBS, where he found that they were shredding a whole load of documents he found from about 110 years of people who'd made deposits in these Swiss banks and then died. And because none of the relatives had been able to claim the money, some had tried, but they couldn't get death certificates, for example, because the people had died in concentration camps. They weren't allowed to have the money. Now, we're talking about hundreds of millions of Swiss francs, sort of dollar equivalent money here. The banks are being a bit cheeky, aren't they? If you deposit the money, your relatives may know about it or not, but if they do, and you've died in the meantime, and then they try and claim it back, and then the banks even say, oh, well, you've got to show us a death certificate, otherwise we won't give you the money. And they've taken this. Basically, what they're doing is just shredding any evidence within their own building that money was ever over there, and they're stealing the goods.
Well, I mean, Swiss banks and Switzerland looks like a terribly nice place, but in all fairness, it is the home of money laundering, as is the City of London.
Anyway, let's have a listen to an extract from this interview, which went out earlier this week, actually, on Dialect, by Christoph Miley, who came to prominence in the late 1990s, having... actually, what happened was he gave the documents that he found that were about to be shredded to some Jewish groups, and then they managed to mount cases against UBS, both in Switzerland and in the United States, that led to hundreds of millions of dollars being recovered.
BITS was founded to support and in World War One.
Now he's talking about the BIS there, just to let you know, it's BIS, which is the Bank for International Settlements, which is an important, it's basically the central banker's central bank, where people like Mark Carney come from and go back to once a month to do all the regulation that led to the, or non-regulation that led to the 2008 financial crisis. So let's have a listen back now to Christoph Miley talking about BIS, or BIS as he calls it.
They supported both sides, the Germans and the French, and then they cashed in. And the same bank was used in World War II to manage Germany. And even today, it's there's no police guy can go into that bank. It's off limits, and it's owned by private Jewish families. They also own the Federal Reserve in America, and they're all Swiss and Swiss Jewish families, Rothschilds. They're German actually, Rothschilds, Loeb. They're in Swiss, and Moscovich. You know, the finance families. And since 200 years, they started with Napoleon. Since 200 years, they control the world through money creation, money printing, and they use the BITS or the Federal Reserve in Washington to control every country in the world. And but the headquarters is in Switzerland. They let other people do wars. They have white gloves, and they have their corporations and their outsource corporations that do the wars. Like right now, it's America that they use to manage all these wars around the world. But America is just in the same footstep that the Germans were. The Germans were used. They were used to rob Europe, but the money was then deposited in the Swiss banks.
Well, you know, there is definitely manipulation going on in the international system. You know, we've got to be quite precise about who we think it really is and what's going on. There are definitely important Jewish families at the core of the international ruling class. The Rothschilds are an obvious point, but it's not just them. Real money talks. You've got plenty of goy in there who aren't Jewish at all, who are just as bad.
There's also
it's not really a religious thing. It's more to do with greed and selfishness.
And also, many of these families tend to be Zionist families too, don't they?
Well, they do. I mean, but you've got to recognise that there's plenty of Christian Zionists who support the State of Israel because it's a gendarme in the Middle East for Western interests. And we've got a transnational ruling class with a substantial Jewish element within it, but it's certainly not a Jewish ruling class. I mean, it's a ruling class with some Jews in it.
But what he's saying there effectively about the Swiss banks, no matter who's controlling them, is that they have this real kind of lock hold on the creation of money, whether it's in the United States through the Federal Reserve or BIS, which was so... I mean, it's fair to say that there's no way that the Nazis could have built up all their military forces without help from this bank in Switzerland.
Well, Montagu Norman, who was the head of the Bank of England when the Nazis invaded Czechoslovakia, he argued that the gold held by the Czech for the Czech government by the Bank for International Settlements should be handed over to the new German regime in Prague, because you know, they were now the new regime and the gold belonged to them. And this was in the weeks running up to World War II. And of course, what he argued was that wars come and go, but banking goes on forever, and we mustn't, you know, the Bank of International Settlements has somehow got to be above World War II. And of course, it was used both by the Germans and the West. And of course, when at the end of World War II, as we're coming to later in this programme, deals were done between ex-Nazis and the Western powers, and NATO was set up using, you know, many of the networks that had been created by the Gestapo in Eastern Europe and elsewhere. And that explains an awful lot about why we've ended up in the mess we're in, because NATO in many ways is a continuation of that Nazi and Western elite cooperation.
Now, what about people like Reinhard Gehlen? He was quite important.
Well, Gehlen was the head of the Gestapo, and he ends up running the German, West German intelligence services. Now, if you were the Russians, that's a pretty clear signal about what you're dealing with in NATO, isn't it? So the former head of the Gestapo is now your intelligence chief. Right, we know what we're dealing with here.
Well, we're going to be talking a bit about Rudolf Hess later, but on this particular point from East Berlin, there was apparently something called the Brown Book on Nazi war criminals, which was circulated, which claimed that 1,800 named major offenders who the Soviet Union and the East Germans wanted to put on trial, possibly for execution, were backing key West German posts. 1,800 or drew large pensions for their work during Hitler's lifetime. Apparently, it listed 15 government ministers, 100 generals and admirals of the revived German armed forces.
Yeah, I mean, it's open knowledge, surely, that elements of the Nazi regime were rehabilitated after World War II because of the and various clandestine networks were set up, the so-called Gladio networks, using fascist intelligence operatives in order to create what were supposedly stay-behind armies to resist a Soviet invasion, but which became terrorist manipulators of West European politics. And we've covered this many times on this show. People shouldn't be surprised. Trump said NATO was obsolete, and it isn't, unfortunately, obsolete. It's horrifyingly still there, but of course it's got no real purpose other than world domination, and that's you know, ultimately going to fail.
I mean, is it NATO just getting increasingly dangerous and crazy as it fights for its own survival?
Well, NATO is an epiphenomenon, really. I mean, if we didn't call it NATO, we'd call it something else. But it's pretty bizarre that the North Atlantic Treaty Organization is sending further reinforcements to the Hindu Kush, which is just about as far away from the North Atlantic as you could possibly go.
Also, we'll, like I said, we'll be talking about Hess in a minute, but let's take a look at the Freemasons in Nazi Germany, because this is one of the questions that I was hoping. I mean, this is something that actually that Jack Lopresti raised, who's a Freemason Conservative MP here in Bristol, when he was on this programme, and it's a very legitimate, valid question. If Hitler and the Nazis picked on the Freemasons, put them in concentration camps, etc., as they did to trade unionists, disabled, Jews, mentally ill, gypsies, etc., during the Third Reich, then surely the Freemasons are actually a persecuted bunch. I mean, anyway, so this is one of the things I was hoping, and my reviewer, former Freemason Ian Mattison, was hoping was going to be tackled in this programme on the Freemasons called Inside the Freemasons, which is going out on Sky TV on Monday nights at 8 o'clock at the moment. And I think we'll probably have another review from Ian when the whole programme is finished, but it'd be a shame to miss it halfway through. So let's have a listen now to Ian Mattison, former Freemason and former Army officer, so what he has to say about the Nazi persecution of Freemasons and the activities of Josef Goebbels.
People went to the gas chambers and went to the concentration camps of various ethnic groups, etc., one of which were Masons. Yes, is what I believe, and that's what I've read. So I would tend to believe that, yes, he did that. However, if you look then at the history of what Goebbels was trying to do at Wewelsburg, in the castle in southern Germany, he was trying to get the Aryan race together. And if you go the inner workings of Wewelsburg down in the cellars of there where he was trying to get this thing together, it looked very much like a similar type of checkered floor, etc., and various ornaments around the area.
Well, what you're suggesting there is that the Nazis had their own kind of version of Freemasonry, and anyone that was outside it that was would possibly be a threat.
You would not be wrong in thinking that if you saw what I saw at what was going on at Wabelsburg. Yeah, well, that was where Goebbels wanted to set up his headquarters afterwards. It's a very distinctive castle. I'm going to let you didn't have a look because it's like in a triangle form with sort of round towers on the apexes of the triangles, and it's quite a sort of distinctive place. But certainly Goebbels wanted to establish back this famous Aryan race going right back into the realms of what was previously Prussia and the old German way. That's what he was trying to do.
Just one of the little bits of insight, quite a lot actually, particularly to do with the rituals that the Freemasons do, which the Sky TV people were not showing you in that series, Martin. Well, what do you make of this idea that Ian, I mean, he should know, he's been in the Freemasons as quite a senior Mason as well before he left back in the 1990s, saying effectively that it was like everything else, that the Nazis were effectively control freaks, so anyone that wasn't in their particular group of Freemasons was potentially a threat to them.
Well, that's right. And if you go back to even earlier periods, like the 18th century, when people like Mozart were Freemasons and so on, the Freemasons, and Franco was very down on the Freemasons as well, because traditionally the Freemasons had a liberal, libertarian philosophy. They were in favour of national self-determination and so on. So they were persecuted by the conservative powers because they were seen as, you know, modernists, really. And, of course, in Nazi Germany, any organisation which wasn't under the control of the government was going to be dealt with. You know, they weren't going to tolerate any organisation other than their own organisation. So it wouldn't surprise me if, you know, presumably if you were cooperative, there wouldn't be a problem. But they're certainly not going to allow people to have secret organisations that they don't control.
Also, another thing that he points out there is that in the programme they're talking about Freemasonry as a secular society, and yet he points out that each lodge has its own chaplain. There are all sorts of quotes from the Bible, including using the Bible in there, and most of the time the chaplains in a Masonic lodge are also, for the rest of us outside, are ministers of the cloth, in other words, vicars and pastors in churches. So is it, do you think, a secular organisation or a religious
organisation? Well, no, I think as far as I understand, Freemasonry has always been an avowedly religious organisation, but with a non-denominational twist. And of course you could argue, well, hang on a minute, how religious is it to set up secret societies which then try to dominate public sector contracts and so on? I think the ruling class has always, as Adam Smith said, even when they meet socially, there's some conspiracy against the public being cooked up. And if Freemasonry didn't exist, something else would be created in order to create the bonds necessary. So the Skull and Bones Society in the US isn't part of traditional Freemasonry, but it's a very important part of socialising the super ruling class, the real insiders, like many of the people in Trump's cabinet, like Mnuchin, for example. He was a Skull and Bones man.
Also, the ritual which Ian talks about in this interview, which will be aired next Tuesday at noon here on BCFM, is the threats of death when you're going in through these rituals. You've got the noose around your neck, which is obviously a threat of death. Then you've got the knife pointed touching your bare chest, a dagger actually, and then the promise that you will allow your fellow Masons to kill you if you break any of their promises. Now, this is actually a bit sinister, isn't it? And it's not like joining a golf club or something.
No, it's not. But you've got to remember when the Freemasons originally started, a lot of them were based on it was based at the time of the Carbonari, as they were called in Italy, and these secret societies were revolutionary societies which were dedicated to the overthrow of foreign domination of Italy or whatever. And this kind of melodramatic, may my tongue be cut out or whatever. That's the kind of, you've got to remember that back in that era, that sort of thing was regarded as kind of fairly normal. And if you think about the Tolpuddle martyrs in England, they were convicted of swearing unlawful oaths, and what they had was a big picture of a skeleton, and that people were told to swear that they would serve, that they would be loyal to the the Grand National Consolidated Trade Union, otherwise, you know, there would be consequences and they would die and so on. This sort of thing sounds sinister today, but you've got to remember the context in which these things originally evolved, which was of secret societies led by romantic students attempting to overthrow what they saw as oppressive governments. And of course it still carries on, and of course Freemasonry today is largely accused of being a club for the super wealthy elite to fix things behind the scenes.
Well, it's, isn't it about privilege and promotion? The other thing is, yeah, is it a religious cult? It seems to be. Also, you know, you're talking about these oaths, having my throat cut across, my tongue torn out by the root and buried in the sand of the sea at low water mark or a cable's length from the shore where the tide regularly ebbs and flows twice in 24 hours. That's just for the first degree. Now, this does remind me of the death of that banker in London, Roberto Calvi
was found hanging from, I think it was Blackfriars Bridge, with bricks in his pocket and so on. And of course he was involved in the Vatican Bank, which had been very much involved in the financing behind things like Gladio, which was running the terrorist networks in Italy during that period. So we know these things go on. We don't know as much as we ought to, but P2 Propaganda Duo was the lodge in Italy which was at the centre of the Gladio scandal. All the top sort of military and industrialists and so on were in it, and they were coordinating all of the terrorism in Italy, according to Imposimato, the head of the Italian Supreme Court.
Well, thanks for bringing up Gladio again, Martin, but that is a perfect cue to introduce one of the most important stories I've seen for a long time. A German soldier posing as a Syrian refugee has been arrested for planning a false flag terror attack at Vienna Airport. Investigators say this lieutenant stashed a gun at Vienna Airport, which was going to be used in an act of state-threatening violence. Now, the troubling thing is that he felt confident, this German soldier, apparently, that he was going to be able to blame this on Syrian refugees.
Well, as I understand it, what he'd done is he'd registered himself as a refugee, and therefore he'd had to give his fingerprints, and he was going to carry out the attack with the gun and escape and leave the gun with his fingerprints on it, which would then lead to the Syrian refugee that he'd been pretending to be getting the blame for the attack. Now, it may be that this is a far-right nationalist soldier who's operated on his own. I think the Austrian police or whoever's caught him have done a very good job here. Because we need more of this. We need to catch these people red-handed. And
it's the German police. And it's worth mentioning that more than 90 German police officers have been set on this case. They've worked alongside Austrian and French security forces, searching 16 locations across three countries, and a suspected accomplice has been arrested in Bavaria.
Yeah. Well, it may be that this is this has been orchestrated by those with political motivation, to try and blame refugees, etc. And of course, that needs to be given publicity, just like Anders Behring Breivik killing scores of Labour Party young socialists in Norway. I mean, these are the terrorists. But on the other hand, I think what we've really got to ask the question is: was he operating alone, or was he operating as part of a Gladio-style provocational network? Because that is the Dortmund beer hall massacre of the 90s was definitely orchestrated from the intelligence services.
Investigations revealed the Bundeswehr lieutenant was stationed at Illkirch Grafenstaden in France. Doesn't sound very French, but anyway, that's before registering as a refugee back in Germany. He gave false information to authorities in Gießen, Hesse, back in 2015, as Germany was overwhelmed by the arrival of almost a million asylum seekers. He apparently spoke French rather than Arabic. The man submitted an asylum application at Zindorf in Bavaria in January last year. As a result, he was given shelter in a refugee home. Amazing that someone can live such a total double life. I mean, is he an undercover agent?
That's got to be the suspicion. Because of what we know about the way the intelligence services have orchestrated these networks in the past, including things like the Dortmund Beer Hall massacre in Germany, the assassination.
I mean, how easy is it to get hold of a fake Syrian passport?
Well, you don't even need a Syrian passport. You just say, I've run away from Syria, I'm Syrian, I'm speaking in French, not Arabic. And then, of course, he presumably wants going to carry out the attack, and then he's going to disappear into the woodwork, and Syrian refugees will be blamed, so that you can bring in more police powers in Germany. It'll encourage the far right to say that these terrible people are killing people in airports, even though in actual fact it's the far right itself that's doing it.
Well, look, hang on, because the soldier was arrested only just a few days after prosecutors revealed the man who orchestrated the Dortmund bus bombings had attempted to frame ISIS to make money on shares. I mean, these don't sound like terrorists to me. Sergei W. A. Jewell, German-Russian national, detonated 3 bombs targeting a bus carrying the Borussia Dortmund football team, seriously injuring one player on the 11th of April. He left misspelled letters, deliberately, it seems, at the scene, claiming the attack was a retaliation for German military intervention against ISIS. But investigators found he wasn't an Islamist, but a trader planning to profit from short-selling shares. I mean, is that terrorism? I suppose it is.
Of course it is. It's all terrorism. Nobody disputes that.
Let's make a few bob.
What we may have here is opportunists of the far right or of the money-making variety.
The other thing is, you know, we have told all about this Dortmund bus bombing of the football team, but nothing hardly about the fact that the guy was, all he was planning to do was to make a few bob at it.
Well, I mean, we're bombarded with all sorts of information all the time, and a lot of misinformation. The fact is that the record shows that NATO's intelligence service have been deeply involved in fomenting terrorism over the last 50 years, and Islamist terrorism in particular.
Also, Martin, at least 2 neo-Nazi terror plots have been uncovered in Germany, while security services have cracked down on the anti-government Reichsbürger movement after one of its members killed a police officer. We hear hardly anything about these white non-Muslim terrorists, do we?
No, we don't, because they're not proper terrorists. They're just, I mean, it's like the killing of Joe Cox. Was that terrorism? Yes, of course it was. The question is, how much of this is orchestrated? And I suspect the strategy of tension is the way it's always been. The intelligence services are running Islamist terrorism, right-wing terrorism, and then demanding more powers to deal with it.
As ever, this will be a link to this article up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But finally, Martin, Rudolf Hess, why did he spend 42 years in jail? Why did his family not allowed to speak to him during that time? He spent over 20 years in Spandau prison in Berlin. Even though he was the only prisoner there, he was allowed to just see his relatives once for half an hour every Christmas, but he wasn't allowed to have any proper conversations with them, and they weren't allowed to record anything about what he'd spoken to them. Now, one of the main reasons that I've just been reading this book called The Bormann Brotherhood, which is by William Stevenson, published in 1973. William Stevenson was a Canadian journalist, TV producer, back during the Second World War and after. He said he wrote the book because he said it was quite clear to him that the West is becoming a deepening nightmare. This is in the 1970s, because there were so many Nazis who seemed to be in key positions.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a general knowledge about this for years, but I don't think people realise how deeply Nazi intelligence networks were embedded in the very creation of NATO. And of course, the techniques used, which include false flag terrorism, i.e. carrying out an attack, pretending it's somebody else in order to get more power, that's very similar to what the Nazis did in the 30s, but it's much more sophisticated.
2 take homes from this. One is that the head of the Gestapo, Heinrich Müller, who was actually trained in the early 1920s, in the Soviet Union, as it was at the time, after the Bolshevik Revolution. And that's where he learnt his techniques, the head of the Gestapo, which does make you wonder, how close, actually, some people have accused the Nazi regime and the Bolshevik regime of having rather too many things in common. But the main reason was because before the Second World War, Hess had been involved in a secret agreement between Hitler and Stalin to invade Poland, and had divided it up, and that was because the beginning of the Second World War. Well, so perhaps that's why they didn't want Hess to be able to talk. to particularly to the press.
Well, I mean, this is speculation. We don't know what Hess knew, because that's why they kept.
Well, if you want, I'll put some of this evidence from this book by this Canadian journalist in the 1970s.
Well, I mean, everybody knows that at that period, Hitler and Stalin were cooperating quite closely, and therefore their various intelligence services and military were cooperating quite closely. The Germans were intending to double cross the Russians all along, but the Russians were too stupid to realise.
Well, one does wonder whether people like Desmond Morton and Bormann had actually, you know, knew about these people like Müller, etc. It's certainly that Müller certainly seems to have survived the war, because his grave is said. We think that he's there. There was a grave found, and it had three bones from three different bodies in it. It certainly wasn't him. Anyway, I think it's time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. I'll put some links up to that quotes from that book about Rudolf Hess. Coming up live on Facebook, it's Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi and Yusuf. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, that's community activists from Hartcliffe, Kerry Bales and Steve Norman from Avonmouth, also to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, our sister show Dialects here on BCFM at noon every Tuesday. This show's story links and comments page is one word, thisweek.org.uk. Download our MP3s and you can listen in the car, iPlayer or anywhere you like. You'll find me on Twitter during the week at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Billy Quain, Saturday edition tomorrow morning, 10 till 12, all the way through till The Real Musical Deal, Sunday evening, 7 till 8 with Danny Lopsch. I'll leave you with music from 2006. Yes, it's the other Freemasons. Do please join us at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.